Chapter 21. It was after sunup now, but we went right on and didn't tie up. The king and the duke turned out by and by, looking pretty rusty. But after they jumped overboard and took a swim, it chippered them up a good deal. After breakfast, the king, he took a seat on a corner of the raft and pulled off his boots and rolled up his breeches and let his legs dangle in the water so as to be comfortable and lit his pipe and went to getting his Romeo and Juliet by heart. When he had got it pretty good, him and the duke begun to practice it together. The duke had to learn him over and over again how to say every speech. And he made him sigh and put his hand on his heart, and after a while he said he'd done it pretty well. Only, he says, you mustn't bellow out Romeo that way like a bull. You must say it soft and sick and languishy. So, Romeo. That's the idea. For Juliet's a dear, sweet, mere child of a girl, you know, and she don't bray like a jackass. Well, next they got out a couple of long swords that the duke made out of oak laths and begun to practice the sword fight. The duke called himself Richard III. And the way they laid on and pranced around the raft was grand to see. But by and by the king tripped and fell overboard, and after that they took a rest and had a talk about all kinds of adventures they'd had in other times along the river. After dinner, the duke says, "Well, Capet, we'll want to make this a first-class show, you know, so I guess we'll add a little more to it. We want a little something to answer encores with, anyway." "What's encores, Bilgewater?" The duke told him, and then says, "I'll answer by doing the Highland Fling or the Sailor's Hornpipe. And you, well, let me see. Oh, I've got it. You can do Hamlet's Soliloquy."
"Hamlet's which?"
"Hamlet's Soliloquy. You know, the most celebrated thing in Shakespeare. Ah, it's sublime, sublime. Always fetches the house. I haven't got it in the book. I've only got one volume. But I reckon I can piece it out from memory. I'll just walk up and down a minute and see if I can call it back from recollection's vaults." So he went to marching up and down, thinking and frowning horrible every now and then. Then he would hoist up his eyebrows. Next he would squeeze his hand on his forehead and stagger back and kind of moan. Next he would sigh, and next he'd let on to drop a tear. It was beautiful to see him. By and by he got it. He told us to give attention. Then he strikes a most noble attitude, with one leg shoved forwards and his arms stretched away up and his head tilted back, looking up at the sky. And then he begins to rip and rave and grit his teeth. And after that, all through his speech he howled and spread around and swelled up his chest and just knocked the spots out of any actin' ever I see before. This is the speech. I learned it easy enough while he was learning it to the king. "To be or not to be. That is the bare bodkin that makes calamity of so long life. For who would fardels bear till Burnham Wood do come to Dunsinane, but that the fear of something after death murders the innocent sleep, great nature's second course, and makes us rather sling the arrows of outrageous fortune than fly to others we know not of. There's the respect must give us pause. Wake Duncan with thy knockin'. I would thou couldst. For who would bear the whips and scorns of time, the oppressor's wrong, the proud man's contumely, the law's delay, and the quietus which his pangs might take, in the dead waste and middle of the night, when churchyards yawn in customary suits of solemn black? But that the undiscovered country, from whose bourne no traveller returns, breathes forth contagion on the world, and thus the native hue of resolution, like the poor cat of the adage, is sicklied o'er with care, and all the clouds that lowered o'er our housetops, with this regard their currents turn awry, and lose the name of action. 'Tis a consummation devoutly to be wished. But soft you, the fair Ophelia! Ope not thy ponderous and marble jaws, but get thee to a nunnery. Go!" Well, the old man, he liked that speech, and he mighty soon got it so he could do it first rate. It seemed like he was just born for it, and when he had his hand in and was excited, it was perfectly lovely the way he would rip and tear and rear up behind when he was getting it off. The first chance we got, the duke, he had some show bills printed, and after that, for 2 or 3 days, as we floated along, the raft was a most uncommon lively place, for there weren't nothing but sword fighting and rehearsing, as the duke called it, going on all the time. One morning, when we was pretty well down the state of Arkansas, we come inside of a little one-horse town in a big bend, so we tied up about 3/4 of a mile above it, in the mouth of a creek which was shut in like a tunnel by the cypress trees. and all of us but Jim took the canoe and went down there to see if there was any chance in that place for our show. We struck it mighty lucky. There was going to be a circus there that afternoon, and the country people was already beginning to come in all kinds of old shackly wagons and on horses. The circus would leave before night, so our show would have a pretty good chance. The Duke, he hired the courthouse, and we went around and stuck up our bills. They read like this. Shakespearean Revival. Wonderful attraction for one night only. The world-renowned tragedians, David Garrick the Younger of Drury Lane Theatre, London, and Edmund Kean the Elder of the Royal Haymarket Theatre, Whitechapel, Pudding Lane, Piccadilly, London, and the Royal Continental Theatres, in their sublime Shakespearean spectacle entitled The Balcony Scene in Romeo and Juliet. Romeo, Mr. Garrick. Juliet, Mr. Kean. Assisted by the whole strength of the company. New costumes, new scenery, new appointments. Also, the thrilling, masterly, and blood-curdling broadsword conflict in Richard III. Richard III, Mr. Garrick. Richmond, Mr. Kean. Also, by special request, Hamlet's Immortal Soliloquy by the illustrious Kean. Done by him 300 consecutive nights in Paris. For one night only, on account of imperative European engagements. Admission, 25 cents. Children and servants, 10 cents. Then we went loafing around the town. The stores and houses was most all old, shackly, dried-up frame concerns that had never been painted. They were set up 3 or 4 foot above ground on stilts, so as to be out of reach of the water when the river was overflowed. The houses had little gardens around them, but they didn't seem to raise hardly anything in them but jimson weeds and sunflowers and ash piles and old curled-up boots and shoes and pieces of bottles and rags and played-out tinware. The fences was made of different kinds of boards nailed on at different times, and they leaned every which way and had gates that didn't generally have but one hinge, a leather one. Some of the fences had been whitewashed, some time or another, but the Duke said it was in Columbus's time, like enough. There was generally hogs in the garden and people driving them out. All the stores was along one street. They had white domestic awnings in front, and the country people hitched their horses to the awning posts. There was empty dry goods boxes under the awnings and loafers roosting on them all day long, whittling them with their Barlow knives, and chawing tobacco and gaping and yawning and stretching, a mighty ornery lot. They generally had on yellow straw hats, most as wide as an umbrella, but didn't wear no coats nor waistcoats. They called one another Bill and Buck and Hank and Joe and Andy, and talked lazy and drawly and used considerable many cuss words. There was as many as one loafer leaning up against every awning post, and he most always had his hands in his breeches pockets, except when he fetched them out to lend a chaw tobacco or scratch. What a body was hearing amongst them all the time was, "Give me a chaw of tobacco, Hank." "Can't. I ain't got but one chaw left. Ask Bill." Maybe Bill, he gives him a chaw. Maybe he lies and says he ain't got none. Some of them kinds of loafers never has a cent in the world nor a chaw of tobacco of their own. They get all their chawing by borrowing. They say to a fella, "I wish you'd lend me a chaw, Jack. I just this minute gave Ben Thompson the last chaw I had." Which is a lie pretty much every time. It don't fool nobody but a stranger. But Jack ain't no stranger, so he says, "You give him a chaw, did you? So did your sister's cat's grandmother. You pay me back the chaws you've already borrowed off'n me, Leif Buckner. Then I'll loan you 1 or 2 ton of it and won't charge you no back interest nuther." "Well, I did pay you back some of it once." "Yes, you did, about 6 chaws. You borrowed store tobacco and paid back niggerhead." Store tobacco is flat black plug, but these fellas mostly chaws the natural leaf twisted. When they borrow a chaw, they don't generally cut it off with a knife, but they set the plug in between their teeth and gnaw with their teeth and tug at the plug with their hands till they get it in two. Then sometimes the one that owns the tobacco looks mournful at it when it's handed back and says sarcastic, "Here, give me the chaw and you take the plug." All the streets and lanes was just mud. They weren't nothing else but mud. Mud as black as tar and nigh about a foot deep in some places, and 2 or 3 inches deep in all the places. The hogs loafed and grunted around everywheres. You'd see a muddy sow and a litter of pigs come lazying along the street and wallop herself right down in the way where folks had to walk around her, and she'd stretch out and shut her eyes and wave her ears whilst the pigs was milking her, and look as happy as if she was on salary. And pretty soon you'd hear a loafer sing out, "Hi, so boy, sick him tag," and away the sow would go squealing most horrible, with a dog or two swinging to each ear, and 3 or 4 dozen more a-coming. And then you would see all the loafers get up and watch the thing out of sight and laugh at the fun and look grateful for the noise. Then they'd settle back again till there was a dog fight. There couldn't anything wake 'em up all over and make 'em happy all over like a dog fight, unless it might be putting turpentine on a stray dog and setting fire to him, or tying a tin pan to his tail and see him run himself to death.